The link between madness and the confessional poets.
Many of these sort of, you know, early pioneers of confessional poetry were also admitted to hospitals. Some were at McLean, some were area mental hospitals in the 1950s. And that's where confessional poetry was born. It was born in these wards. And I was like, wow, that is an incredible story. I really want to tell that story. I want to explore how this beautiful sort of important movement in literature was born.
That's Lee Kravitz. We talk with him about his stunning literary mystery, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. Then, as more states pass laws attacking transgender families, we listen back to a clip from my 2019 interview with Mimi LeMay about her memoir of her transgender son, What We Will Become. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Lee Kravitz's first published book was Strange Contagion, Inside the Surprising Science of Infectious Behaviors and Viral Emotions. It came out of his work as a psychologist. But Kravitz always knew he wanted to be a novelist. And boy, are we lucky he succeeded. His debut novel, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P., has just been released to rave reviews. Blending past and present, and told through three interwoven narratives, it reimagines a chapter in the life of Sylvia Plath, telling the story behind the creation of her semi-autobiographical novel, The Bell Jar. The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. is brilliant and beautifully written, a literary mystery that never ceases to surprise and delight the reader. Lee Kravitz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Before we get into the interview proper, I just would really love to share the beauty of your writing with our listeners. I've chosen just a paragraph from chapter or stanza 19, Estée 2019. Set it up for us and then read that.
Okay, got it. So at this point in the novel, so Esty is a curator at an auction house in Boston, and she is sort of tasked with trying to figure out if these notebooks that have shown up in her possession may or may not be, you know, Sylvia Plath's original draft of The Bell Jar. And throughout her storyline and her journey, you know, she tries to sort of uncover the provenance of these notebooks, but also, you know, what Sylvia Plath means to her and her personal connection to the manuscripts and to the Bell Jar in general. So the notebooks are about to go up for auction. And at this point, it looks like Esty is sort of in this basement sort of security room, sort of observing these notebooks. There's three notebooks, and she's just sort of thinking about what might happen to them if they actually go out into the world and are sold. Life is poetry, its symmetry and rhythm. We return to the places where we began. In the safe holdings room, I observe the three notebooks of The Bell Jar laid out before me on the table like physical evidence in a trial. It is early, 6:30 in the morning. St. Ambrose Auction House is quiet. The chamber I share with these objects possesses a somber air, but also one of wonder over the strange clockwork of the universe, the mathematics of coincidence, the propulsive instincts of objects, inanimate and otherwise, to wind their way back to the places and people. I do not believe in fate. Objects find a home the way a river deposits sand. Sometimes, however, time and circumstance align again and again. Such is the case, it appears, with the notebooks, my mother and me.
Mm. It's beautiful. And we won't explore what she means by that because we will let the reader discover it. But now tell us about the premise of this novel. This is these three notebooks of the bell jar. How did they arrive in this book?
Yeah, so they kind of come in sort of a fun, odd, strange, funny sort of way. So Esty is a curator at this small auction house that's sort of struggling in Boston. And one day, these two brothers show up, and they've discovered in this house that their business is flipping houses, and they've discovered a lockbox in this old house. And inside this lockbox are three notebooks. They're spiral bound, sort of very, you know, cheap notebooks. And they bring them to the auction house because they figure if something is found in an attic in a box and it's all dusty, it might be worth something. And so Esty is looking at it, and she has a sneaking suspicion that these aren't just any notebooks. And in fact, when she opens them up, she discovers that somebody's actually purposefully transcribed every word of the bell jar into these three notebooks. And she suspects really that these notebooks might actually be the original first draft of Sylvia Plath's famous novel, but it doesn't really make sense to her because the novel wasn't written in Boston. It was actually written in London, or right outside of it. And the fact that it showed up in this random house in this random attic makes no sense as well. So this sets her out on a journey to sort of discover, well, what are these notebooks and who really wrote them and what's their significance?
The novel moves between three different time periods. So this first one is 2019, luckily pre-pandemic.
That's right.
No complications there.
And no, you know, it's interesting. Somebody asked me recently, like, what would it be like to write a story or a novel that takes place in 2020 through 2022? And yeah, it's hard. How, you know, are writers going to be writing books with people in masks the entire time? Are we going to have this whole window of time that isn't really covered in novels and literature? I mean, it's very hard to even wrap your head around. But no, this one actually does take place in 2019.
Yeah, that's great. Then there is the story of Dr. Ruth Barnhouse, an actual person, in 1953. And then there is Boston Rhodes, that's R-H-O-D-E-S, in 1958. That's the pen name of a poet. So you've told us a little bit about Esty. Tell us about Ruth Barnhouse and Boston Rhodes.
Right. So the idea behind The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. is really to explore how Sylvia Plath came to write The Bell Jar, what influenced her, and also the significance of The Bell Jar, you know, after it was published and, of course, after she died. And so I really wanted to explore sort of the ripple effect of Sylvia Plath and her artistry throughout, you know, her life and beyond it. And so in order to do that, I had to go back to the beginning. And so Dr. Ruth Barnhouse is, like you said, a real person. She was one of the very first psychiatrists, female psychiatrists in New England and possibly even the country. So she was way ahead of her time. And she was at McLean Hospital when Sylvia Plath is admitted in 1952. And in real life and also in the novel, she winds up sort of taking on sort of a mother figure, as well as obviously a doctor presence in her life, who sort of nurses Sylvia back to health after she's admitted for manic depression, what we call today bipolar disorder. So in the novel, I sort of show how Dr. Ruth Barnhouse takes Sylvia under her wing and teaches her how to channel all of her sort of demons into writing and actually learning to read again as well, because Sylvia, when she's admitted, is in such a state that she can't read anymore and she can't write anymore. She can't even pick up a pencil. And so Ruth Barnhouse sort of teaches her, you know, how to pick up that pencil again and how to use it and how to channel that. And that's just one of many unorthodox methods that Ruth Barnhouse uses to sort of bring Sylvia back to life.
And this is based on reality. You yourself were a psychotherapist at McLean, is that right?
Well, sort of. So before I became a novelist, I'd always wanted to be a writer. And of course, at the age of 30, I looked around. And I was like, I'm not getting anywhere. And I'm trying really hard and I just don't know what to write. So I went back to graduate school and I became a psychologist, actually, here in California. And so I live in just south of San Francisco. And part of my graduate work, I was working at a mental hospital, which I was actually sort of surprised to find myself working in as well. It was a little jarring, as these things are supposed to be, right? They're mental hospitals. But it turns out it was the same mental hospital that Ken Kesey had worked at a generation earlier when he was inspired and started to write One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And so there was something in the air there, you know, something that sort of re-sparked my imagination. And one day I was walking through the ward and there was a kiosk in the waiting room where all the patients are. When you're in a mental hospital, it's a really boring place for, you know, for patients. They're recovering in many ways. And the idea is to bring the mood down and the temperature down. So there's a lot of books. And there was a copy of The Bell Jar in the kiosk. And I picked it up and I had read it years earlier. I can't even tell you when I read it originally because it's always sort of been, you know, in my head. And I'm reading it. And as I'm reading, you know, The Bell Jar is sort of, it's a thinly veiled novel that's based on reality. And Sylvia Plath, you know, genuinely was admitted to McLean Hospital. And of course, her character in The Bell Jar is admitted to a hospital at the same age for the same reasons. So as I'm reading it, it also sort of occurs to me that what I'm reading is also the parallel story, not just of Sylvia Plath, but it's the story of how confessional poetry was developed and introduced into the world. Because before the 1950s, poetry wasn't as raw and confessional and honest and brutal about thoughts and feelings that we kind of know it is today. And so, you know, Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, Robert Lowell, many of these sort of, you know, early pioneers of confessional poetry were also admitted to hospitals, somewhere at McLean and somewhere area mental hospitals in the 1950s. And that's where confessional poetry was born. It was born in these wards. And I was like, wow, that is an incredible story. I really want to tell that story. I want to explore how this beautiful sort of important movement in literature was born. And so I knew that The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. would start off one storyline in a mental hospital, but then you also sort of move it 10 years forward to the classroom of Robert Lowell, the poet who famously had this poetry workshop at Boston University. And Sylvia, as a young woman, you know, long out of the hospital, shows up in his writer's workshop and is introduced to a character named Boston Rhodes, who is a brilliant poet herself and has basically the world on her plate. Like, she is about to take the crown when it comes to confessional poetry. She's brilliant. She's an incredible writer. And it turns out she is also deeply jealous and threatened by Sylvia Plath, whose talent is so pure and so perfect and shiny that she realizes she needs to crush her in order to get ahead.
You based her loosely on Anne Sexton. I mean, was there a kind of rivalry there?
There was. Anne, I love Anne Sexton. I thought for a while that this novel would be more about Anne Sexton than anybody else, because I think that her story is spectacular. I mean, she was almost 30 years old before she started writing poetry. And before that, she was a housewife and a mother of two. And she really was struggling deeply and mightily with bipolar disorder as well. And one day, you know, she picks up a pen and decides to write a sonnet. I think she hears a sonnet on TV as she's watching PBS, and cut to a year and a half later, and she is the de facto sort of, chair of the confessional poetry movement. I love her. I love her poetry. I love her as a human being. But her relationship to Sylvia Plath was definitely fraught. They respected each other. In fact, they sort of worked off of each other. If you read Sylvia's poetry, she has poems about beekeepers, And then Anne Sexton had poems about beekeepers. So they sort of influenced each other. But there was absolutely sort of underneath that, this sort of tension that was sort of bristling. And while they pushed each other, there was also some resentment, but also deep, deep love and affection for each other. I knew that that was a place I needed to start. If I was going to build a rival for Sylvia Plath, it needed to be somebody who looked and acted just like Sylvia. And so Anne Sexton was sort of that sort of character. But then I needed to sort of take that much, much farther. And so that became the inspiration for Boston Rhodes, who, you know, is very, very different from Anne Sexton in that regard, because she goes to places that are incredibly dark, very, very fast, and does some things that are highly unethical and quite scary. And so I tip my hat to Anne Sexton. And I even, you know, at the end of the book, I sort of dedicate and cite her as a huge inspiration. But she's absolutely not Boston Rhodes in real life, because Boston Rhodes is an awful, awful human being.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Lee Kravitz about his beautiful, stunning novel, really, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. Yeah, she says, in fact, at some point in the book, Boston Rhodes says that the venom voice made her a major voice in poetry. So I'm going to ask you, is Boston Rhodes a good poet?
Boston Rhodes is a great poet. Boston Rhodes, she attributes her poetry, the voice that she discovers while writing her poetry, she attributes it as her venom voice. It's the voice that is full of poison. And that's what makes her poetry so raw and beautiful. And I think it's what most people, you know, in the novel sort of relate to. You know, she's there writing about abortion. She's writing about, you know, lust. She's writing about thoughts of death. And she's writing about the death of her own father. And she's writing about rivals. And rivalry and hate and spite. And these are all things, you know, if you think about the traditional sort of housewife of the 1950s and early 60s, this does not fit that sort of stereotype. And both in the novel and in real life, I think that the world wasn't quite ready for confessional poetry and what it sort of unleashed onto the world stage. But that's what made her so great. And that's why I love Boston Rhodes, because she's so good. But with the good comes the bad.
Now, there is some of her poetry in this book, so I assume you wrote it.
I did. There's I wasn't much of a poet before I started writing The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. But talk about a venom voice. One of the techniques that I've used when writing this book is, And God, I hope nobody ever listens to this. I actually have recordings on my phone of me sort of riffing and pontificating and going on and on about observations in the world of the world in her voice, and, you know, really sort of like moving into her skin and putting on her clothes and, you know, in my mind, and really sort of embodying who she was. And I'll tell you, as soon as I did that, it's sort of like a character actor. You start to sort of channel that venom voice. And she was such a delight to sort of write for, that it wasn't just that I could write, you know, dialogue for her and behaviors and actions and all the sort of the tensions that she feels. But that I actually got to a point where I could actually write her poetry. And it really didn't feel like me writing it. It really felt like Boston Rhodes writing each and every word.
You know, another aspect of this book is, you know, this is a rivalry of two women poets who are, you know, who right there, it was something unusual in the 1950s in the sense of just women were suppressed in general in the 50s and the 60s. They're in a rivalry with each other. And I felt that this was in many ways a real feminist novel. And in fact, at first I assumed that you were a woman because your name.
You're not alone. You're not alone. In fact, I get that quite a bit. Even when my publicist first started talking with me, when we jumped on the phone, she was sort of taken aback. She was like, I thought you were a woman. I was like, yeah. I actually take that as a huge compliment. And I, you know, as I started writing this, I actually sort of worried, am I going to be able to pull this off? Because, you know, I do sort of take on the the characters of three women, three distinct women in this novel. And I wanted to do it right. And I wanted to do it well. And I wanted to do it with honesty and truth. But I also was really, really aware that this is such a delicate topic, and more so now than ever, for good reasons, right? Can and should a male writer write from the perspective of his female characters? On the one hand, you say to yourself, well, it's the job, right? The job is to do that. But the job is to do it well. And if I fail at it, then it's all on me. But I also sort of took the stance of, you know, I wasn't looking at these characters at, you know, from the perspective of women, honestly. I was thinking of it as a psychologist, looking at the way that people sort of respond to art. And so the story sort of informed me, you know, where it wanted to go and who these characters needed to be. And it's interesting, Dr. Ruth Barnhouse was always going to be there. And so she was female. Boston Rhodes was always going to be there. And because she was basically the equal and opposite of Sylvia Plath, she also had to be a female. But the modern story with Esty, the curator, I went through iteration after iteration after iteration, trying different characters for that storyline. And most of them were men. And it just wasn't working. It wasn't working. The parallel structure wasn't working. The motivation wasn't right. It just didn't seem authentic and genuine. And then all of a sudden it clicked. And I was like, this has to be Esty. Esty has to be the narrator. It has to be a story about three women and how they influenced and pushed Sylvia and vice versa. And I don't know, that's just where the story went. And then all of a sudden it became a very feminist novel, full of deep complexities and hopefully truth as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it rang so true. I mean, it just felt like a novel written by a woman. So you pulled it off.
Thank you very, very much.
So you just said before that Esty is the narrator, but in fact, Boston Rhodes is also a narrator. And I wanted to ask you about the layers of how you wrote this. There's a point in the book where Esty has hired a historian or archivist who says that there are three narratives in the notebooks. One is the narrative of the book itself. The other is a narrative of the process of writing the book. And the other is the narrator, what happens to the notebooks. And when I read that, I thought, well, that's kind of the way this novel is structured as well. So could you talk about that?
Absolutely. So you nailed it. You nailed it. That's exactly what the book is trying to do. The idea is, you know, it's no coincidence that the notebooks that Esty is, you know, finds herself in possession of, there's three of them. And in The Last Confessions of Sylvia P., there's three storylines. And at some point they discuss, the significance of three, which is, you know, you look at these notebooks and it's literally the story of the bell jar. It's also, because it's handwritten, the process of writing the bell jar. So there you got the past and then you got the present. And then it's about the legacy of what happens to these notebooks afterwards as well. And I love the interplay, the way that the story sort of spin around each other throughout. And I really wanted to sort of create this sort of kaleidoscope effect. And so, right, you have Dr. Ruth Barnhouse, who's all about, you know, the past. And you've got Boston Rhodes sort of pushing and pulling Sylvia Plath as she comes to the point of actually literally writing the novel. And then Esty finds herself in possession of sort of the caregiver of what happens to this legacy, of Sylvia Plath, as well as, you know, physically the notebooks themselves. And she, you know, is deeply concerned when she realizes what she has, like, what is she supposed to do with it? And what is our responsibility both to the art and the artist? And how does the world view the art? And is she responsible for, you know, sort of ushering that into the future as well? So she's in a place of power and she's never really been in a place of power before. And she becomes a sort of caregiver of Sylvia Plath in a way that Dr. Ruth Barnhouse and even Boston Rhodes find themselves in at some point. So they're all carrying her.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about Ruth Barnhouse. You've just spoken about her role. She says in the novel, or maybe I think somebody actually says to her, that treatment is a window of reprieve from madness. And I have to confess, I was a psychotherapist for 10 years. So I really had to think about what you meant by that, because of course, when we treat people, we want to cure them.
Right.
So talk about that perspective and talk about Ruth Barnhouse, her methods, and how they contrasted with the kind of treatment that Sylvia Plath actually got there.
We could definitely go into psychology here and theories of psychology. I love that you told me that. That's wonderful. So Dr. Ruth Barnhouse, her philosophy is that, you know, grief and trauma and depression and manic depression and all of these things, they make up the whole of a person. And in many ways, we never really let go of those things. So, you know, I worked a lot with trauma survivors. And one of the principles of working with trauma is that you don't ever necessarily let go of what happened. It is always there. It is always a part of our lives. But the idea is to sort of acknowledge the trauma or the experience and sort of wrap your arms around it, embrace it, but don't let it, ideally, don't let it affect you the way that it did when it was sort of ruining and hurting your life. When it comes to, you know, mental illness like bipolar disorder, especially bipolar disorder, you know, you can treat it in real life. You can treat it with, you know, with medications and, you know, psychotherapy and, but it is a lifelong battle, just like depression can be a lifelong battle or anxiety is a lifelong battle. And you can always sort of dampen it and treat it and help people sort of live with it. But it is a window of reprieve. At least that's what Dr. Ruth Barnhouse feels. You know, we come to learn that she has a major, you know, sort of tragedy in her own life that has sort of driven her to a place of real vulnerability. And she comes to learn through Sylvia that it's something she needs to be able to hold, even if it means that she can't let it go, like truly let it go. And if you look at Sylvia Plath, Sylvia Plath's life was a life of treatment, of sort of moving through life and the joys and sorrows of life, even while she was still suffering from manic depression. And of course, ultimately, it's the thing that sort of drove her to end her life as well. And I think that that's a side of psychology that we don't, as practitioners, ever really talk about, which is, you know, do we ever really cure mental illness, or do we just open up windows of reprieve where we're able to sort of live life to our fullest, you know, in spite of the sort of demons we carry or the mental illness that we suffer through.
And I love that term to hold the trauma, because it implies both containing it and cradling it, nurturing it, you know, nurturing oneself by containing it and accepting it and acknowledging it. So it's a really beautiful term there.
Thank you. You know, there's a sort of a theme through the novel about bees and beekeeping. One of the treatments that Ruth Barnhouse in the novel, not in real life, this is just for the novel, does with Sylvia, she sort of brings her out into these bee boxes, and she sort of helps Sylvia sort of engage with these insects that sort of fly around in these beautiful formations and create honey and hives and all these sorts of things. And, you know, the metaphor for me, that's in my mind, a beautiful metaphor for mental illness in general, where you can sort of sit back and watch these bees sort of move in what looks almost like a contained shape. But the reality is we can't control them at all. And that's mental illness. That's bipolar disorder. That's depression, anxiety, trauma. It's uncontainable, even though they, you know, occasionally we can put them back in their box.
Lee Kravitz, talking about his debut novel, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. Stay tuned for more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Now let's get back to my interview with Lee Kravitz about his acclaimed debut novel, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. Sylvia Plath, as everyone knows, committed suicide. Have you ever had a patient commit suicide who was under your care?
Yeah, I have. So I'm no longer seeing clients anymore, but when I was, I did. I had some young people. We call in California, we call it 5150, where we hospitalize people who are both, you know, have suicidal ideation, but also have made attempts. So I've had a number of patients or clients who were 5150 for that reason. Some very, very scary things. And I actually had a client whose father, in the middle of treatment, while I was working with this client, his father shockingly died by suicide. And it came out of nowhere. There was no sign, no sort of indicator that this was ever going to happen. I mean, and it did. And so my first nonfiction book, my solo nonfiction book, was called Strange Contagion. And that's really how I got my start in writing, was writing about nonfiction. And there was a town nearby here in Palo Alto where 10 students from a local high school died by suicide. And I look at sort of the ramifications of that and how a town sort of learns to cope and bounce forward, given such tragedy and trauma. So I think that's always sort of been, you know, in my back pocket, so to speak. Like, I understand what that is like and what that trauma can be like for people. And I don't take it lightly at all. In fact, I struggled mightily with how to show, you know, Sylvia's sort of descent into her own sort of ultimate demise within this novel. And I did it like I did with the other storylines, which is all, you know, I come at it from the side. You know, there's people who are responding to it. There are people who are sort of witnessing the after effects of her death. But I never even attempt to get into her head when she takes her own life, because I think that's, it would have been irresponsible. I don't think it would have been honest or true. And I think it would have been a real disservice to what Sylvia was really sort of going through at that time.
Could you say a little bit more about that? About why is it dishonest?
It's sort of out of respect. It's also, you know, when you write a novel, it's obviously it's full of fiction, but you want to get at the kernel of truth within every character. And it becomes even more important when you're writing about people who are real in real life. And as a practitioner, but also as a novelist, you sort of understand that you can never really understand why somebody does what they do. When Sylvia died, let's be clear, her life, first of all, she was having her manic depression. She was in the depression cycle and it was very, very deep. Her husband had left her for another woman. Her kids had been sick with a cold for months. She was living with her children in a very small place with no heat. And she was destitute. She was alone. Her therapist, Ruth Barnhouse, was all the way over in Boston, while Sylvia was alone in a place that she really knew very few people over in England. And so she was spiraling, and you can read her notes. I mean, she was a beautiful writer, both in her journals as well as her poetry. In her letters to Ruth Barnhouse, there's real desperation. So you can find some truth there. But what, you know, leads a person to ultimately do what she did, which is a pretty horrific thing, right? She died by suicide, gassing herself in her kitchen with her children in the next room. And it's a pretty horrific, very desperate sort of moment. And to try to, you know, to recreate that and to step into her headspace while she's doing this, you know, I like to think that I got to know Sylvia, you know, pretty well while I was working on this book. And it felt wrong to sort of presume that this is why she did it or what she was thinking when she did it. All I can do is really, you know, as a responsible, writer is to, you know, handle this with care and the respect that I think that she deserves as a human being, not just a writer that the world, you know, sort of feels they own, so to speak.
Several people in the novel blame themselves for Sylvia's suicide. That includes actually Boston Rhodes to a degree, Robert Lowell, Ruth Barnhouse. What well did you dip into for those feelings of guilt?
Sure. You know, it's, you know, if you think that there are multiple people in Sylvia's life who can legitimately lay claim to helping build up the person that Sylvia became, whether it's her therapist or her psychiatrist, I mean, her literary rival, her teacher, her lover, her husband. If you assume that all of these people played a part in her life, then you also have to assume that they may have played a part in her death as well. And so at some point, I mean, even Esty, you know, who years after the fact discovers these notebooks, she feels a responsibility for her life and as well as her death as well, which is, you know, you sort of have to read to sort of understand why. And so, yeah, they do feel a sense of responsibility for her. They feel a sense of ownership again. And their feelings for her are deeply, deeply complex. And so in real life, if you read, you know, Ted Hughes's notes and some of his interviews, he obviously blames himself. The world really blamed Ted Hughes for Sylvia's sort of, you know, decision to die by suicide, which I always thought was, he kind of got a bum rap, right? You know, you can't really ever blame anybody else for somebody else's decisions. But I think that just really speaks to how much Sylvia influenced their lives and how they, you know, held Sylvia within theirs. I mean, there are some artists and there's some pieces of art that we don't even really understand how they fit into our lives or where they sort of sit in our consciousness or within our hearts. I think Sylvia was absolutely that sort of person for many people, especially the characters in my novel. But even when I rediscovered her, you know, like I said before, I had read The Bell Jar when I was young. I don't remember reading it, but I know I read it because I remembered every beat of the novel and every character within it and the voice of the novel. So it resides in my mind, in my soul, in my heart, in a place that I can't even quite understand. And this is somebody who wrote a piece of literature 55 years earlier. So the people that were closest to Sylvia, I think, felt the same way they must have. And they didn't know where to, you know, sort of place blame or, you know, their feelings of rivalry or their love. I think that's the sort of person Sylvia was. She inspired and instilled in them deeply complex and confusing emotions.
And now I'd like to go back to Robert Lowell. He also spent time at McLean, suffered from manic depression. So Robert Lowell is a key figure in this book. I mean, he's not a prominent character, but he's an important character. And what was interesting to me is that, yes, this is a feminist novel, and these two women poets, Sylvia Plath and Boston Rhodes, are really looking to Robert Lowell for acknowledgement, for acceptance, for proof that they're good poets, which is a kind of awkward thing for a feminist novel. So could you talk a little bit about Robert Lowell as a poet and his own complexities and what his role is in this book?
Thank you. It's a beautiful question. Robert Lowell is a character who is, again, also deeply complex in his desires and what he wants. And in fact, one of the fun things to write about him was that we never really know where he's at. We don't know what he's thinking. We see him storm across his workshop, reading his students' poetry aloud in this bombastic voice. But he's also a character who doesn't let people in. There's more questions about him than answers. Each of his students looks to him. At first, they think it's about wanting his respect. But in reality, it's really about them trying to figure out what the heck this guy's thinking, which is funny because his poetry was so raw and honest. So in his literature and his writing and his art, he was very, very honest. But as a human being, he was so hard to sort of figure out. And it sort of puts all of these very sort of strong characters on their heels a little bit. At first, Boston Rhodes wants to gain his respect and to gain his acknowledgement. And at some point, she winds up moving beyond him. And she sees him as a father figure at some point, but then she moves beyond that as well. He, it's a miracle, from what I understand in real life, that he would show up in class at all, and that he would actually have 2 hours where he was somewhat lucid, because, you know, he had moments of mania, and, you know, in his sort of a manic state that rivaled, I think, Sylvia and Anne Sexton's, where he was drank a lot. There were women, you know, stories of women everywhere. There were, you know, stories of him literally losing his mind. You know, there's a scene in the novel where he's arrested, and he's, when they pick him up, they bail him out, he's rambling about Napoleon and the demons and hell and Satan, and he's going on and on and on. And that is exactly what he was like, more often than not, especially towards the end. So at some point, you know, Boston Rhodes sees her idol, so to speak, as this very vulnerable human being. And that sort of keys her in some ways to Sylvia's state of mind as well. And so it adds a little bit of humanity, I guess you'd call it, or sort of empathy that Ruth Barnhouse, I'm sorry, that Boston Rhodes has up until this point never experienced.
Now, you mentioned before you wrote this nonfiction book. I know about that those cases. I'm moved to read that book of yours. And what's the title?
It's called Strange Contagion, and it was my first foray into you know, really writing. Although I've been writing forever, but yeah, Strange Contagion. It looks at the thoughts, feelings, and emotions that we all feel and think and exhibit, and it shows how our actions influence other people around us. And that can be both for good purposes and for purposes that are less good.
Yes, exactly. So I wanted to ask you, this is your debut novel, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. What did you learn about writing when you made the shift from nonfiction to fiction?
Yeah. So if, you know, my nonfiction has always been very narrative driven. So by the time I finished, you know, working on that, it was almost like everything was pushing me toward becoming a novelist. You know, so there's scene, there's tension, there's desire in every scene that you write, in nonfiction as well, really. But it's funny. My agent, who's absolutely wonderful, he called me after Strange Contagion came out, and he's like, Lee, what are you working on next? What nonfiction are we doing next? What can I sell? And I said, hold on to your hat. I'm writing a novel. And he stops me and he says, Lee, don't write fiction. And I said, why? And he goes, every nonfiction writer wants to be a novelist. And I said, yeah, well, that includes me. And he goes, don't do this. Stick with nonfiction. And I said, you know, I don't know about that. So I turned in my first draft to him, and he called me up and he said, you know, he paused very thoughtfully and he said, this is going to be your first novel. And he said, I think you're on your way. So it's sort of where I find myself now, and it's where I want to, you know, keep on going.
That's beautiful. And how are decisions different when you're writing fiction about people who really existed?
Yeah, gosh, it is. I'll tell you, when I first started writing this book, I adhered to the facts almost as though I were a reporter. And I realized about halfway through the process that it was so hard to do. Because it, you know, if you're going into the realm of fiction, it gives you a certain amount of license. And so, I mean, you could take it pretty extreme. I mean, there's revisionist history. Philip Roth, you know, wrote the novel, The Plot Against America. And, you know, that whole novel, which was brilliant, was revisionist history. Michael Chabon wrote the Yiddish Policeman's Union, which the entire thing is based on revisionist history, which was beautiful and really well done. I didn't want to take it that far, but it is a constant sort of balancing and a constant conversation you have with each other. Do I adhere to the truth so much that it sort of inhibits the story, or do you take the spirit of the real person and sort of take it from there. And in many cases, I chose the latter. And once I did that, the novel really opened up for me. You know, I never have Sylvia doing anything that isn't Sylvia, right? Like she would never do something that's not her. But I do think that I take some liberties, which I even, you know, you have to acknowledge, you know, with the real life characters. When you're writing dialogue for Robert Lowell, obviously in real life, he didn't say these things to Boston Rhodes because Boston Rhodes did not exist. But that's the wonderful thing about being a historical fiction novelist is that you can sort of take these real life people and put them just a little bit into the realm of speculation, because the spirit of who they are is the thing that influences the book much more than who they really, really were.
Well, it is just a stunning novel. A terrific read, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. Lee Kravitz, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation.
It was a pleasure. I'd come back anytime. Thank you.
Lee Kravitz. Go to writersvoice.net to hear an audio excerpt from his novel, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. On March 7th, the Florida Republican-led legislature signed what's being called the Don't Say Gay Bill. Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to sign it. It forbids discussions in schools of sexual orientation and gender identity in grades K through 3. Meanwhile, Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott just signed a directive to the state child welfare agency to investigate reports of children receiving gender-affirming care as, quote, child abuse. Several hospitals have already suspended such care as a result. These kinds of laws and executive actions are likely to spread across GOP-led states, and experts say they will be devastating for transgender kids and families. Back in 2019, we spoke with Mimi LeMay, a parent of a transgender child and author of the memoir, What We Will Become, A Mother, a Son, and a Journey of Transformation. The book runs on two converging tracks, Mimi LeMay's own story of growing up and the story of her young transgender son. Born anatomically female, Jacob knew from the age of 3 that he was a boy. What We May Become tells how his parents came to realize and honor their son's gender identity, allowing him to transition at the age of 4. Before that time, LeMay refers to the child who would become Jacob as M. Let's listen to a clip from that conversation. So let's get to M's story. Pretty early on, some problems emerged in her behavior, puzzling behaviors. I wonder if we could start off by having you read from page 136. This is dated February 24th, 2013. This is a letter for M's third birthday, a letter to her. Read from that letter.
Mm-hmm. February 24th, 2013. Happy third birthday to the incomparable M. LeMay. We are so proud of you. You are an ardent individualist. You love things with a passion. Your favorite color is gray. Your fervor for Rudolph and all things Christmas keeps the holiday going. You've worn the same doggy sweater for 4 months, day and night. You love scotch tape and sticky notepads. You are kind and empathetic. You insist you are a boy. Your favorite headgear is a propeller beanie, not a tiara. You are a terrific little kid and wonderful sister. Daddy and I hope you always stay true to yourself. So in reading this, I actually wrote this to my son at what I knew of as my daughter at the time, but it was also for public consumption because I put it on Facebook. And I can read through the lines that, you know, I picked the things that were most charming and unique about my child, but there was a lot going on behind the scenes that was worrisome. And that was the transformation, what we had of a very happy toddler into a moody and obsessive child, all the while a child who told us again and again, as clearly as they could, I am a boy. I'm not a girl.
Yes. And yet it also took a while for you to almost take that in. It's kind of like what you read. You think you are a boy. That's just dropped into the middle there, almost part of the background. When did this kind of signal really begin to separate from the noise for you?
It took us at least 7 or 8 months of our son telling us again and again, I am a boy, along with, you know, a decline in his behavior and his mood, you know, and all these red herrings, all this obsession over different clothes. We were just trying to muddle through this. It felt like a mystery. We didn't know what was going on. We thought, oh, sensory perception disorder. He did have a diagnosis for that. Oh, middle child syndrome. For one brief moment, I entertained the idea that he had a past life, something that I don't really credit most, you know, in my regular life. But we were grasping at straws. But when it really hit was in his third year, right before Christmas break. He was in preschool, and his teacher pulled out a drawing for me, and it was of some stick figures, some people all, you know, the whole drawing was in thick black marker with clouds everywhere. It was an angry drawing. You can see that. And he had written his given name like they told him to, but then she pointed it to me and she said, and, you know, immediately M crossed it out. Yeah. And it just hit me that it, you know, it was hovering right above my conscious mind, but it hit me this for this kid, this is real. This is reality. The reality is, for whatever reason that I may not understand yet, my child knows that they are a boy and this has to be taken seriously.
Is that how you put it, though, to yourself, that he knows he's a boy? Or did you at that time say
this is real for him, that this is, you know, he believes he is a boy? I don't think I comprehended yet that kids could be transgender at a young age. That's something that I hadn't been aware of. So his reality that he's a boy, this is real for him. The stakes are higher now because it's real for him. The fact that it wasn't real for me yet, that took some education. That took some understanding on my part.
Yeah. And so talk about that education, or really, what did you find? What can you tell our listeners about, some people call it gender dysphoria disorder. They treat it like a disorder. Other people say it's gender nonconforming. What did you find about kids this young who have this?
So I'm happy to say it's not considered a disorder anymore. That was a bit of a misnomer, which could be harmful, because I think what parents need to understand about trans kids is that this is a normal variation of the human experience, of the experience of gender, which is, we're increasingly becoming aware that it is on a spectrum. And what a transgender child feels and knows about themselves is that their identity, their deeply felt sense of who they are in respect to gender, will be not aligned with the sex that they were assigned at birth. So my son was assigned female at birth, but his identity as he developed was that of a boy. And mostly what I discovered was that a lot of these kids, what's different than just a stage or play acting, is that they are persistent and consistent in their identification. And usually this is accompanied by a sense of urgency from the child that if they are affirmed, if they get support from the beginning, this can not develop into dysphoria. They can be perfectly happy in their identity as a trans kid if they're affirmed. But when they are denied, or when there is a pushback over time, that frequently leads to dysphoria and sadness. The journey is different for every child. Some have more dysphoria. Some have more body dysphoria, that sense that their body isn't the way that they want it to be. It's not the body that people typically identify with the gender that they are. And some of them don't have that strong dysphoria. We are very lucky. Jacob doesn't have right now, he's 9 years old. He has transitioned 5 years ago. He is very steady in his identity as a boy, again, persistent and consistent. And he has less of that body dysphoria than he had when he was younger.
Does that mean then that he's comfortable with having, with being anatomically female, but an identity as a boy? Is that what you're saying?
He is not in day-to-day distress about it. And that is, again, that's his journey. Every child is different. He does very much want to go through the transitions that are available to him when he's older, the medical transitions. So he is very firm about that, but he is not experiencing daily distress, which we are very lucky about.
And how do you differentiate this, say, from, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, which was a long time ago, girls definitely did not have as much fun as boys. And I really wanted to be a boy when I was a young child. And I was a tomboy and I wouldn't wear dresses. And I can remember kind of looking down, you know, under my pants every day to waiting for something to grow there that never did. But I certainly don't think I ever thought I was a boy. So talk about the differences, because I think a lot of people might confuse them.
Yes. And I think that's a fabulous question. And I can also identify with, you know, your experience as well, because I also was a tomboy for a while. I was getting into fights with people. I didn't like to be, you know, typified as girly. But you said something very key. You never believed or identified deeply as who you are as a boy.
Right.
You saw some experiences that you wanted. You probably noted very keenly, the way children do, that we gender things in our society and that some of these genderings are very unfair. That's very different than that deep innate sense. It has nothing to do with the toys or the clothes. It is persistent through time of knowing yourself as a boy or a girl.
Mimi LeMay talking with us in 2019 about her memoir, What We Will Become, A Mother, A Son, and A Journey of Transformation. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the whole interview. And coming up next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with John Nichols about his latest book, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.